I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to Deep Dish Radio. I'm Tim Powers, and this is my show. Hey, I am really glad that you have joined me today. I am really excited about today's guests, which are a pair of filmmakers who are creating a documentary about Charlton Comics, a comics publisher from the 40s all the way through the 80s. And while you may not have heard of them, their influence on the industry and on even today's popular culture is pretty impressive. It's going to be a neat. Well, first of all, I love the interview, but the story that they're going to get around to telling is even better. And we'll introduce them in just a little bit. I have really enjoyed getting emails from you and some Twitter messages and things like that. So I'd like to encourage you to do more of that, folks. Go ahead. If there's something you want to hear on the show, you want to give me some feedback, I would love that. Email me. My email address is tim@deepdishradio.com. That's tim@deepdishradio.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. It is @deepdishradio. And I understand that there is a Facebook page as well. So if you are on the Facebook, look for me, Deep Dish Radio, right there on Facebook. We've also been getting some listens all over the world. I check just about every day to see when and who and how people are listening to this silly little show. So if you're in Holtsville, New York, thank you very much. You've been listening quite a bit. We're getting hits from France and Russia and Turkey and Japan. Thank you very much. We're really glad that you are a part of the show. And thanks to my friend Ian Lee, we've got a spike in the UK. So thank you very much. I am honored as I sit here in my little Los Angeles basement putting this little show together for you. I am honored that my voice is heard all around the world. And I'd like to hear yours, actually. So if you have something you want to share with me, tim@deepdishradio, or I welcome your tweets on Twitter @deepdishradio. There's all kinds of great stuff coming up in episodes in the future. So if you are a fan of all the things that we talk about here on the show, everything from music to comics to movies to television to just whatever strikes my fancy, please continue to join us. Thank you very, very much. It is really a pleasure hearing from you. So Charlton Comics, I always considered them kind of the Shasta of comics. It was never quite Coke or Pepsi, but if you got one, it was pretty good. You know, it was a publishing company in Connecticut that was started by a couple of guys who met in prison, and it lasted, like I said, all the way through the golden age of World War II comics, all the way through the 50s into the 80s. And when I started reading comics in 1975, there they were on the stands, and I always looked at them because I didn't recognize any of the characters. I knew my Supermans and I knew my Batmans, but never recognized any of those. But they published horror comics and romance and crime and funny animals. But they're probably most famous now, known for their action heroes, which is their term for the superheroes. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But they never got as popular as your Batmans or your Captain Americas. But the talent that came out of Charlton was world class. So let me throw a few names at you, see if you recognize any of them. Denny O'Neill, Jim Aparo, Bob Layton, my pal Bob Layton, Don Newton, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, which a comics artist friend of mine calls the master, Paul Kupperberg, Steve Ditko, the creator of Spider-Man, Neil Adams, one of the most influential artists on today's comics, and a couple of kids from Cleveland named Siegel and Shuster. You might have heard of some of the things that they did. So despite not being big sellers or super popular characters, you know, they never had the flagship character of a Superman or a Spider-Man. Without Charlton, there would not have been The Watchmen, probably one of the most important comics ever published. And, well, my guests today, Keith and Jackie, are not only comic fans, but they are world-class filmmakers. And they're finally putting together a chronicle of the important cornerstone of comics history in a documentary called Charlton Comics, The Movie. And it's going to feature a lot of really, really interesting things. So if you love comics and you appreciate the history of the medium, this is for you. If you have an interest on how American art meets American commerce, this is for you. So, buckle in. You're going to meet Keith and Jackie right after this.
It's Deep Dish Podcast. Subscribe today and tell a friend about Deep Dish Podcast with Tim Powers. With Tim Powers.
Why don't we get started? You guys introduce yourselves so that people can recognize your voices as we talk.
Oh, me first?
Yeah, you go first.
I was going to let you go first.
You can go first. I always go first.
I'm chivalrous. Keith Larson, co-producer of Charlton Comics, The Movie.
And I'm Jackie Zabushka, the other co-producer of Charlton Comics, The Movie.
And for, gosh, I don't know how long this project's been around, but I've been aware of it for about a year now. And you've been trying to tell the story of Charlton. I always thought of them as the number three publisher in the 70s, and I don't know if that's accurate or not, but the story behind it's arguable. The content was always good. The content was always interesting. And the story behind it, the story behind the actual publication and how it all happened is really fascinating. Tell me a little bit about what we can expect from Charlton Comics, The Movie.
A lot of humor. Yeah, I think if it was a Charlton comic, it would be like, you know, hilarious stories, or, you know, it'd be one of those goofy titles, like, you know,
or even Unbelievable Tales.
Unbelievable tales of funniness. Zaniness.
Tales of the unexpected.
That, you know what? Yeah, at every turn, honestly. You know, the whole thing, the genesis was that we went to a panel, stumbled into it by accident, because we saw the players' names who were hosting this panel, the Danny O'Neills, Bob Laytons, and what have you.
Right.
And we got in with expecting to hear their stories of, you know, their illustrious careers behind Batman, Iron Man, etc. And instead they talked about Charlton. And to be honest, we weren't happy about that at first.
No, we were like, I didn't even know what they were. Keith had like vague recollections. And so we're like, well, let's just give it the polite 5 minutes, rest our feet up, and then we'll very politely slink out the back. But within 2 minutes, we moved to the front row so we could hear better, because these stories just sucked us right in. They're completely unbelievable, but and absolutely true.
And I think what's actually funny about that is we were with two other people who did leave the panel.
Yeah.
And then came back toward the end and you know, were upset that they missed it. So
suckers.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that was the inspiration. Just the goofy stories we heard there are kind of the ones that we put into that first trailer that we launched last year.
The talent that came out of Charlton, who you know, who worked at Charlton, are you know, luminaries of the industry. So we're looking at Steve Ditko, we're looking at John Byrne, Joe Staton, Don Newton.
Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster.
They did a brief spell there.
I understand they're responsible for some comics, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then, yeah, like Denny and even Neil Adams did some stuff there for a while. And, you know, just about anybody, Joe Sinnott, I mean, it goes on and on. Dick Giordano, of course.
Of course.
You know, it's somehow, in some way, just about everybody who went on to bigger and better did something there, part-time, extra cash, started there, what have you. Mike Zeck, I mean, like, it goes on and on. You know?
Yeah. The problem is that with when they went out of publication, there was no way to find out who actually did this work. So you have people today who know the stories because they read the comics, but people who are new and unfamiliar to Charlton, they have no idea.
Is that because all the records were lost in the fire?
Well, it's not. It's just so much as nobody really put it up on the internet. Charlton didn't really have its resurgence until the early 1999. Actually, was the first Yahoo group that appeared for Charlton Comics, where a bunch of fans got together and some of the creators and started rehashing old stories and trading covers. But it's funny, when we ran our Indiegogo campaign last October, some of the comments on some of our news posts about it were like, how can you be called, you know, lifelong comic book nerds and you've never heard of Charlton? And it's like, well, I was still in Pampers when they went out of business. And Keith probably had to hold a hand across the street. So
no, I was in high school, but, you know, I remember seeing the Charltons on the racks and they just, when I was young, you know, I started reading comics in the late 70s and I was into Marvel and DC and that just didn't appeal to me.
Right.
You know, I see army books and Western books and spooky books, and I'm just like, whatever, I don't want those. And they look cheap, you know, on the same rack. They look really budget. You
know, yeah, relative to the Marvels and even the DCs at the time, Charlton, you know, the printing was a little off, the colors were a little loud, even the ads looked a little chintzy, and
the covers weren't even glossy. They were just flat, you know, just.
And a lot of them were painted. I remember.
Yeah.
If you do collect them and you put them in the bags and boards, be very careful when you tape them shut because the tape will literally peel the ink right off the paper.
Or rip the cover in half. Yeah.
So be very careful.
I have several damaged old Charlton comics that I've self-inflicted wounds on.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Trying to put it back in the bag and the tape grabs and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, once it sticks, that's it.
That's it.
Well, let's back up and do the teaser story on the history of Charlton Comics. How did Charlton Comics start? He said, lobbing you a softball.
Yeah.
It was the brainchild of a man who was in construction and a man who was a lawyer, and they both got busted for white collar crimes and don't know exactly how they met in prison, but they did. And they somehow decided, let's start a publishing company. And they named it after their two sons, who were both named Charles, so it became Charlton. But John Santangelo, he was a construction worker, and he got into printing song lyrics illegally. And he was busted by ASCAP for that. And then Ed Levy was a lawyer out of New Haven, Connecticut, and he was busted as part of a $1.2 million embezzlement scheme for the city of Waterbury. He's one of 26 that took a fall for it.
Wow.
But that's the history of where the company got started.
One of the first song pirates.
Yeah. He was called the godfather of bootlegging, according to Variety.
That's beautiful.
I'd be proud of that title.
Yeah, no kidding. So in 1930, whatever, he's publishing Tin Pan Alley song lyrics.
Yep.
And illegally.
The reason why he was so successful is that you could purchase the music, but you had to purchase the lyrics with the song sheets for 35 cents per song. He got the brilliant idea to get, I'll think, about 10 songs, photocopy just the lyrics onto a large card, something like 11 by 17, and he would distribute them to storefronts and newsstands and say, charge 10 cents, you keep 5 cents, I'll pick up whatever you don't sell in the other 5 cents. And very shortly, he was selling over 7 million copies a month, and ASCAP quickly took notice.
Wholesale bootlegging.
Yeah.
Crazy.
The man knew business, that's for sure.
But, you know, he made a decent amount of money. He comes out and Charlton Publishing comes out, and they legitimize this song lyrics business, and that becomes the foundation of the publishing company, is that right?
Yeah, their first publication was Hit Parader, and from literal start to literal finish, that was their breadwinner. That was the first thing they printed. That was the last thing they sold when the company went under. So that was their bread and butter. They did have a couple other song magazines, Country Song Roundup, and they acquired Hit Songs from another company that was their rival.
Wow. And that survived through the 80s.
It did. And Hip Parader, I mean, when that was sold, it finally went belly up, I think, in 2008 was when the magazine ceased publishing. But I think Charlton, they sold that in 1992. I'm not sure for how much, but that was their baby.
You wonder what song they looked at and go, we just can't do this anymore. You know, what was on the charts in 1992 where they're like, no, we're not going to publish these lyrics anymore.
Yeah.
And so they're publishing, they're printing legitimate magazines, and they look at each other and they say, well, the presses need to run at night. What can we do? Right.
Well, it wasn't so much of that. They figured that it wasn't cost effective to shut them down overnight. So they thought, how can we keep them running? And so that's where the content
and still generate revenue.
Yeah.
You know, so, interesting.
Yeah, they weren't dummies. They knew they could sell comic books.
Yeah.
They just didn't really put much QA behind it.
Clearly. Clearly. But the thing about Charlton is everything was in that one Connecticut plant, right? All the talent, all of the editorial, even the presses were right there in that building, right?
It was between 150 and 200,000 square feet, and I guess it took about 5 minutes to go to end to end walking.
It's like 7.5 acres or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, with including the parking lot, of course.
Yeah.
And they had a core of talent inside, but a lot of them also worked from home and would mail their stuff in.
Yeah, I can't imagine Ditko leaving New York.
He actually did. He
would stay in a hotel.
Joe Gill, they rented out rooms from a hotel that was in downtown Derby. So that's where Steve would come, and he would stay in that hotel, commute to the factory, and then go back to New York in his off time.
Crazy.
Yeah. But a guy like Joe Sinnott would do his at night, his romance comics. He'd just bang them out at night and then after dinner and then just mail them in.
Wow.
Yeah. So he never really went down there ever. Joe Staten worked remote. A lot of them did. But, yeah.
What have you guys discovered about Charlton fandom as you go through this project?
It is alive and well. It's out there. And the thing is, though, is a lot of people... Some people are on the Facebook page, which is pretty active. They've got about 2,000 members there. It's called just in case people want to join in, it's called The Charlton Arrow on Facebook. That's a pretty active community. But there are still people out there who aren't social media inclined, but you see them at the cons and they're leaping through boxes. Like, the love is definitely there.
Now, are these folks older than Keith and me, or are they of all ages?
Oh my gosh!
I love how you quickly determine how we're about the same age.
Keith, you and I started reading comics about the same time, so I'm going to guess we're about the same age.
Yeah, like Demon in a Bottle era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. About the time Kirby returned to Captain America, and we're all set. Yeah.
But actually. Last year at a con, Terrificon at Mohegan Sun, which is happening in August. It's a good show. You should check it out.
Right.
Mort Todd, who was one of the founders of the Charlton Neo Media, he introduced us to a 15-year-old boy who was very much into comics, but he got bored with Marvel and DC, and so he wanted something else, and he discovered Charlton at an antique shop. So he's our youngest fan that we're aware of, and this kid knows his stuff.
And he's constantly emailing us about, I went to this tag sale, and I found this and this and that. And I went to the assignment store, and I got Spooky Tales number whatever. And, it's hilarious. He's so into it.
Yeah.
But he knows his stuff. He's like, he knows more than a lot of comic historians that we've come across.
Yeah, I mean, he'll just pop off and say, like, oh, yeah, a nine-panel page, typical Ditko.
I want to adopt this kid. That's adorable.
So we quickly after meeting him realized that he should be part of the film because of his age mostly.
Right.
Yeah.
And we thought we'd go down and do a token 10 or 15 minute interview with him because just, you know, a young Charlton fan is kind of cool in this day and age.
Right.
He ends up being this like amazingly astute kid.
Yeah.
I think we did an hour 15, hour 20.
Yeah, just the things that came out of his mouth were just like, you're so...
He might be more than one token soundbite in the movie, I have
absolutely
a feeling. Yeah. He was shockingly well-read.
Yeah.
That's astounding. You would think that there would be a resurgence of interest in Charlton following Watchmen. either following the publication of the comic or even following the publication of the movie.
Yeah.
Was there a spike or was there not a spike?
I don't
think so. You know, you can make the same argument for when they put, you know, Blue Beetle, Booster Gold, or Captain Atom in the Justice League. And I don't think people realize where those characters came from. I really don't.
Yeah, if you look at the online press, there really wasn't a huge cross-promotion to recognize origin stories, very sadly. The geeks know, but the New Age geeks don't.
Well, right. It kind of reminds me of we came across a guy dressed as Rorschach at one of these cons, and we just stopped him to goof and ask him some questions, and he didn't know where the character came from. So we told him, and now he follows us.
Yeah.
He comes to all our panels.
Yeah, he's a religious fan now.
Yeah.
But does he come dressed as the question? I suppose that's
no. He still comes as Rorschach, but you know.
But at least he knows now. But he had the Rorschach mask on, and we did a quick interview with him, and I was just feeding him lines so he could repeat them back to camera. And so we call the shows like yours behind his mask. And so I go, well, do you know where Rorschach came from? And no, and I said, he's based on a character called The Question, and he's okay. And I said, do you know who he's created by? And he goes, no. And I go, okay, he's created by a man called Steve Ditko. Do you know who he is? No. Okay, co-creator of Spider-Man.
That's awesome.
So
he started emailing us and telling us that he started researching the character and he found it fascinating. And now he's in our, yeah, we find him in the audience a lot at the panels. So.
Yeah. He's
wow.
Great.
There's not a lot of reprint for Charlton. So if you really want to dig deep, you've got to go into some old guys' long boxes or your tag shops and stuff like that.
Yeah. If you want to read the Action Heroes, DC did those DC Masterworks and they reprinted a lot of the old Charlton.
Oh, yeah.
But aside from that, you're right. They're virtually impossible.
Your Fightin' Fives and your Tales of the Unexpected are not readily available.
They're not cheap. That's what bothers us. You know, we were going to buy a bunch of them for B-roll and stuff, and you go in there, like, they weren't like $10 for a beat up old Unusual Tales or something. It's like, what?
Yeah,
come on. They hold their value for some reason, probably because they were low print runs and there aren't many left. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. A lot of my recollection of Charlton toward the in the 70s and 80s, a lot of it was licensed material that they picked up after I think Gold Key stopped doing licensing or whatever. And I remember a story that Joe Staton told me about doing the $6 million man, where he got hired to do the book and there was no reference material and there was no VCRs at the time. And he lived so far out that did he tell you the story where he couldn't pick up the TV station? He couldn't pick up the network that ran the $6 million man.
So, I don't know if he told us that.
No.
Yeah, he had to get a hotel room in an area that actually picked up the $6 million man and drew from the television.
That's great. We heard similar stories at that panel we went to where they'd get the toys from the toy company and they'd say, well, what's the backstory of the heroes and villains? Ah, whatever, just do whatever you want, you know, was what they were told to do. Just some goofy stuff. You know, and then, you know, they were told, you know, we've been told that they had free reign, a lot of these guys, creatively. John Samangelo barely paid them a visit. And if he did, it was usually because he was touring somebody through the factory. So, you know, they got to do what they wanted, pretty much. As Paul Kupperberg says in the trailer, within the boundaries of good taste and the comics code.
But, I mean, how often did Charlton really run into issues with the comics code? You know, I mean, is it something that they took? Is it something they took into consideration?
Their pre-code horror stories were pretty graphic, but I mean, it was really along the same lines of what Marvel and DC were doing. They just, when you didn't have somebody, you know, dog watching you, I guess the boobs were bigger and the blood was more plentiful. And then when someone says, you know, erase that cleavage line, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, okay, and it's, you have to work with the restrictions.
Right.
Right.
And they were one of the few companies that survived the crash of the 50s.
Right.
You know, even in during that time, they got wiped out by a hurricane and still survived that. So they were pretty resilient, and it's kind of odd that it would end the way it did, considering they were so resilient through all that.
Yeah.
Well, tell me how it ended.
Quite sadly, it lurched and then died. It started in the early 80s where they stopped doing new material. They were just doing reprints.
Doing like three comics in a bag, grab baggy things.
Yeah.
I remember those.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They'd sell them under the modern imprint.
Yeah, yeah, like Toys R Us.
Sears and stuff.
Yeah.
But then they tried Bullseye. They gave that a whirl. I'm not sure if it just didn't do enough in sales. I'm not sure why that failed, but they canceled that pretty quickly.
Charlton Bullseye, by the way, being an anthology title for those of you who aren't hip to the history of Charlton.
Which began as a fanzine in the 70s, and they kind of took the name and rebooted it.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the last printing, the cover date was February of 1986, but everything actually was finished through the presses by October of 1985, the last one being Professor Coffin number 21. But yeah, I'm not even going to say it struggled and died. It was just something like you see something just slowly dying in front of you and no one jumped in to help.
It's like when you hit a possum and it slowly crawls into the weeds.
Yeah.
Well, 85 was an interesting time for the business of comics, because that was about the time that newsstand distribution was drying up and it was going direct market. Was it Charlton's refusal to go along with, you know, to join Diamond or go into the direct distribution market?
I don't even think it's that. I think a lot of it had to do is when John Santangelo Sr. passed away in 79. We learned from George Wildman, who was the executive editor there. He told us that John Santangelo Sr. bailed out the company twice. He really loved his company. And when he passed away, I think the true love behind the company kind of faded away. And everybody else was just in it because it was a job. It was a way to make a living. But nobody cared as
right.
much as he did.
And especially if they didn't care about the comics to begin with, one of the first things to go
would be
the comics.
Yeah.
Interesting, because they, you know, with QC being low to begin with. You know, when the few people who care start to not care, you can kind of watch the heartbeat kind of drop off. It's really, really interesting. But around that time, that's when Paul Levitz bought the Action Heroes for Dick Giordano and brought them over to DC, right?
Yeah, that was in 1983.
Three. Yeah.
Dick had already left, and that's when they started selling off rights. There was a few other titles that, like, there was a man by John Lustig. He heard the Charlton was going under, and he said, "I just want to buy something." And for the most bang for his buck, he acquired Last Kiss, a romance comic, 40 issues for $400. Yeah, and he had no interest in romance. He just wanted to buy something, and so he reissues Last Kiss, but he just changes what's in the word balloons, and he makes it more modern and tongue-in-cheek humor. And then there was a man by Roger Broughton who came down from Canada, and he put everything in a sack and took it with him. And nobody knows where this guy is.
The rumor is he bought the rights to everything. But there's some sidebars to that some of these things might have had copyright lapsed on them already.
Right.
So they didn't own it to sell.
Yeah.
They might have sold it to a separate person in addition. So some characters or some titles might have dual owners. It's a big, big mess at the end. It was just almost like a feeding frenzy, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, because nobody can find Roger, nobody can get the truth.
Yeah. Like, I've even talked to some people who have, they've said they've been in contact with them, but they're not even sure if they were actually speaking with him. This guy's that mysterious.
He'll turn up at a convention at some point, you know?
Yeah, demanding royalties from everything that was used illegally.
That's probably true. But, you know, Charlton also had creator-owned properties. If I remember right, John Byrne's Rogue 2000 and E-Man were owned by their respective creators.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good story, actually. And our interview with Joe Staton has been transcribed into the new Charlton Arrow number 5 comic book. And he talks about what him and Nick Cuddy went through to get E-Man back. It's a pretty interesting story. But yes, they do own the rights to E-Man again. yeah, a lot of it was creator owned for a while. And,
yeah,
you know, it's the copyright thing's a huge
huge mess.
It's completely it's hard. Like I don't know if we'll ever get the true answer on that.
It's difficult. Yeah. If the people are still allowed to tell us what they went through, that's the most truth we'll get out of it. But nitty gritty.
There's a lot of people just kind of shrug. No, I don't know.
Yeah, they honestly don't know.
Don't know.
And the records don't exist anymore.
I think there's very shoddy record keeping. Jackie and I were stunned early on in this project. We stopped by the Derby Historical Society to see what they had on Charlton, and the answer was absolutely nothing.
Wow.
Yeah, which is shocking for something that big and that famous, probably the most successful business to come out of Derby, and definitely the biggest business in Derby. And ironically, they had this book called The History of Derby, the thickest of phone book,
okay.
published by Charlton Press, John St. Angelo, right on the back, donated by John St. Angelo, but there's not a single
blurb
about Charlton in there.
Nothing.
Not even about the fire or the hurricane.
Nothing. And part of one of the challenges we're having putting this show together is we can't find any legacy stuff. We can't find any photos. We can't find. It's weird
really
how scarce the resources are. I mean, Jackie's done an amazing job researching this because there's nothing on the internet. You know, she's had to go back to microfiche. Yeah, like. For the kids under 30 out there who don't know what that is, it's scanned newspapers on a film strip, and you have to look at them through with this magnifying thing. So, you know, it's really weird how under lock and key that whole operation was. There's just nothing there.
You think that's a function of business at the time, or do you think it's a function of the fact that the business started with two guys in a prison cell?
Well, I'll say it has to do with business.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And that's the business. You keep your comics to yourself, and that's all you talk about.
Yeah.
Got it.
There's been a couple people who have... we went to the Derby Library and the head librarian like almost did a backpedal when we mentioned
She gave such a side eye to us when we mentioned the owner's name.
So there was some dubious business connections, we'll say.
It is possible people know more than they're saying, but for the safety, they're not saying a whole lot is what you're telling me.
Do we dare bring up that guy?
Yeah, he's not worth a mention. We talked to a guy that... He definitely alluded to a lot of things that we don't want to mention, only because the connections would be only one generation removed. That's still too close for our comfort. And even in some of the interviews with the guys, they've mentioned things that it would probably be in our best interest.
Unsavory stuff.
I see.
Yeah. I if we were doing a show about the entire publishing thing, we could probably go down that road at the risks of our...
Yeah, so we'll just be alluding to
it. We'll just talk about the phony books, yeah.
All right, cool. So I'll be... If this story ever comes out, I'll be hitting one of the news sites. It'll be local documentary producer finds horse in bed.
We're on the same page, Tim.
All right, got it.
Thank you for reading between the lines.
Enough said there. All right, so Jackie, as you do your research and as you go through this microfiche, which doesn't allow you Boolean string search, so you have to read every damn word on those things, what are some of the weirdest things that you can talk about that you found in your research?
Let me think. I think not so much weird, but it's just finding the who's who work there.
And we're able to start stitching together timelines and events, which will help us really put the narrative together. A lot of that was missing before. It was just a bunch of funny anecdotes.
Yeah, so now it's, I mean, I'm going through microfilm. There have been some fan publications, such as the Charlton Spotlight put out by Michael Ambrose. He's up to issue number 7 or 9, somewhere around there. And then Two Morals Publishing put out a 2-magazine issue all about Charlton back in the early 2000s. So I've taken those. Comic Book Artist Magazine. I've gone through both of those publications, dug things out. When they give me something that can go along with a historical event, then I can cross-reference with newspapers to confirm or deny certain things. But it got to the point where I couldn't contain everything in a notebook. I couldn't do it in an Excel spreadsheet. So I literally cleared one of my dining room walls, and now I'm sticking note cards to the wall with string attaching things that are connected to each other, because the story is just so big that you can't look at it on a single page or flip through a notebook.
Is there concern that it will outgrow the confines of a movie, of a documentary?
It already has.
Yeah, it has.
So we're going to have to whittle it
down. Our goal with the movie is to just keep it in the vein of the trailer, keep it light and moving. You obviously can't tell the tell-all Ken Burns 16-episode marathon thing. If down the road people want something like that, that's fine too.
That's fine.
But we won't say, but we're talking about a companion kind of thing. So.
Yeah. Could we do what? The thing is that there's no love for Charlton on the internet. Nobody has taken the time to give the accolades that this company deserves. And so we want to make sure that if someone sees the documentary and goes, well, wait, there's definitely more to the story, that they have a way to get this.
Yeah, there will be definitely more to the story.
Yeah. And that goes right to talking to people who worked at the factory. And I've made mention, and the message doesn't seem to be getting out there, I want to talk to everybody. If you took out the trash on a single day, if you swept the floors, I want to talk to you. Because you saw things that I can't see, I can't go back and look at, because it's gone.
And on that note, it just seems like the few people we have tried to approach are kind of reluctant to
talk about it. They clam up right away.
Yeah.
There are people who reached out, hey, I work there, you know, and it sounds all great. I reach out, oh my gosh.
It's funny, they come forward and then run away.
Yeah. It's like, hey, can I talk to you? And nothing, dead silence, no email back.
Maybe they woke up with a horse head in the bed.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Apparently there's still some kind of stronghold.
The question is, why come forward if you don't want to participate? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, perhaps they come forward and then they are persuaded to take a few steps backwards.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then based on that, and I say this with all due respect, is there any concern for your own safety as you dig deep in this?
That's why we're only going to talk about the funny books.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, and it's hard because, you know, how do you vet this and how do you prove certain statements? If, like you said, a lot of the players are gone. So it's all rumor, hearsay, and conjecture. And it's not our job to say this is the truth. It's a documentary, which means we're documenting what we hear.
Right.
So, you know, will the movie have complete truth in it? Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. But we're going to try to be as truthful as we can. We'll do our best. But the goal of the movie is to entertain people for a good hour and a half, hour 45, you know, and leave them walking away with, you know, like the panel did for us. You walk away going, I never knew that. That's really cool. It's really interesting. And maybe spurn them to start reading the new Charlton Neo comics or start trying to find old Charlton comics or just, you know, do a little research and become a little comic historian. That's the goal of the movie.
Well,
beyond that, you know, we'll see where it goes.
That brings up a good point. Obviously, you both love comics as a medium. And so as you go down the Charlton rabbit hole, where are the great comics? Where are the really essential reading Charltons? What are the ones that we need to pick up and read?
Well, here's the thing. Charlton had something for everybody.
Yeah.
So you're not limited like to just superheroes or just horror. You've got Western. You've got romance. And I will say, even if you're not into romance comics, you should really check them out because the storylines are absolutely hilarious. You've got secretaries who are in love with their bosses and they're fat, so they lose all the weight and then suddenly he marries them. Like, laugh out loud kind of stupid tales, like women
sensibilities from the time. Yeah,
it's so they're fun just for like a haha moment, but that the best part is that you can find something for everybody.
I read one that was done in the 70s. It had this hippie hitchhiker guy, and he's, you know, no worry about like getting killed or mugged or anything. Oh yeah, let's hop in this car. You know, the people pick him up are like, oh, he looks safe, and oh, it's just hilarious. You know, to go back in the time machine to the way people, you know, the sensibilities, the way people thought is fun.
And I mean, we've got comics like Black Fury, which is the adventures of a black stallion horse. There's really is something for everyone.
That's a good, Jackie made a great point. There's something for everyone. So if you have a certain interest, you'll find it at Jonathan.
Yeah. You know, that's actually a very good point. The action hero books were interesting. And I've kind of dug back into some of the licensed books, like George Wildman's Popeye.
Right.
I think really holds its own against, and Sagendorf's Popeye comics were a pretty high standard for Popeye stories.
Yeah.
But George Wildman's stories and art, I think, hold up toe-to-toe against anything else, you know?
I think that a lot of that has to do is that George said that he loved Popeye since he was a kid. And so when Gold Key gave the properties over to Charlton, his stipulation was, I'll become the executive editor if I can have Popeye.
Right.
I want that to be my book. So there was a lot of love going into that. And I think that's why they're so good, is that the people who did these stories, they really loved what they were doing. They loved their characters. They took pride in them.
And because he was an illustrator, it kept him active. He got to draw and be creative, not just be the boss, you know.
Yeah.
Humping around the factory, telling people to meet their deadlines or what have you. So, yeah, we were lucky enough to talk to him about a month before he passed. So, yeah, he'll be in the movie.
Fantastic. Yeah, when he passed, I called my friend Bobby London, who was the newspaper artist for Popeye at the time that the Charlton books were coming out. And I'm like, I don't know if you ever met the guy, but I would imagine there's a fraternity of people who were caregivers for Popeye during his publishing. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, you know, I met him once and he was really nice to me and I loved his work. And I'm like, well, that says a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a framed Popeye he drew for me on that day.
On my
wall.
Yeah.
Would you mind sending me a picture of that? That would be really cool.
I'll do that. Yeah. We all got one. He did one for the grips and everybody that day. Yeah.
How cool.
Yeah. He was great.
Even cooler though, is that George rebranded the Charlton Comics logo.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
He took it upon himself one day he was taking a woodworking class and he made the Charlton bullseye in a woodworking class. And someone said something about just, you know, varnish it and leave it as is. And he goes, no, I want to paint this and I want to bring it to a meeting and I want to present it. And so he painted it with the blue and white and red that we know today. He brought it to the meeting. They fell head over heels in love with it. And so he's responsible for the bullseye rebranding.
Wow.
Which led to the bullseye, you know, naming, of
the
course.
Naming, yeah. And then even cooler, because George was in advertising, he knew how to get the word out. So he took the tractor trailers that were for deliveries for Charlton and he put the comic book heroes on the side of the tractor trailer so they were mobile billboards. So
no, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he had advertising going across the country up into Canada. So people knew, and the truckers got a kick out of it because other truckers would recognize them because of their trucks.
Yeah, comic book characters all over the trucks. That's kind of cool. Yeah.
In the 70s when that kind of stuff wasn't happening, you know?
Right. Yeah. It wasn't happening. Like, they were soup to nuts, like you brought up earlier. They did everything front to back. They didn't go through a single third party, which you never see again.
Have you found sales records?
No.
Because I'm curious what, like, the best-selling Charlton titles were.
No, and it's funny. Like, even when DC acquired the Action Hero line, they asked Charlton to send over their records, and they said, oh, we don't have them. And then some guy who was a fan of Charlton who was trying to get a publishing deal through them visited the factory, and he found them. and he told Giordano, he goes, hey, I found those stats that you were looking for. I wasn't allowed to take them, but if you send a liaison down, they're in this room in this pile, so go pick them up. I don't know if that ever happened.
Do you have sales figures? No, we don't got no sales figures.
Well, and it's funny, the E-Man licensing, when Joe Staten and Nick Cuddy were trying to get the E-Man, all Charlton wanted them to do is pay off the debt that they had on the title at the time. They didn't put a value on the character. They just said, here's how much we owe, pay that, and it's yours. So,
wow. And yeah. That book only ran like 13 issues with Charlton.
Yeah, it didn't go very long.
So they essentially made E-Man an indentured servant.
You know, before we go any further, I just wanted to make one more mention about George Wildman's Bullseye logo.
Absolutely.
The wood thing, which was awesome to see. He never put his name on it, and Jackie got him to sign it.
Yeah, so it's been authenticated.
He authenticated it, and it's crazy to think that, you know, he passed a month later, and it was shocking to us that he did. But, yeah, it's like you kind of, that's history right there. You forced history on that man.
I forced history.
And we have footage of him signing it.
Yeah. Now, does his estate actually have the bullseye, or do you guys have it?
Carl's awesome.
His son, Carl, who actually worked at the factory, which is cool too, because Carl Wildman's been a huge asset. He set up the interview with George, but also he tells us about the people who worked there and what went on in the factory. Carl has everything. And George saved a lot. He didn't get rid of much. So it's nice that Carl loved that material as much as his dad did.
And Carl's told us since we visited, George got re-inspired and started digging it out.
Yeah, that was when I talked to Carl, like maybe 2 days after the interview, just to catch up again. He said, you know, my dad was so excited to hear that Charlton wasn't gone. It's still alive. It's just alive in a different medium.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and we should probably give credit on the fact that it's coming back to Fester and Mort and Paul Kupperberg and all the Roger McKenzie and the guys who have decided to resuscitate it and rebrand it and put out new books.
There's a man that goes by the name of Fester Faceplant, and he started he was looking for more information on Charlton and couldn't find it. So he started the Charlton Reading Library, where you can go online, you can read some of the old Charlton comics. And he has such a following on there that he started a Facebook page in 2011. And then a lot of the comic book creators from Charlton joined in on this Facebook page. And somebody said, hey, what are you guys going to do now? And so now Charlton Neo Media was born. And the official resurgence was in 2014, before we got the idea for the documentary.
Yeah, when we pitched the idea to Denny O'Neill, Paul Kupperberg, and Bob Layton at the con, Paul, I think they're on issue 2 of the Charlton Era at the time. It just come out.
Yep, and they are. It's available on Comixology, so you don't even have to leave your house to pick up copies of the...
You can get them on Amazon.
You go right to morttodd.com, morttodd.com.
Yeah, and Mort's actually got a bunch of titles now. It's not just Charlton Era. There's a whole bunch.
He's even got, like, Ditko's Weird Tales, which is an all Ditko book.
A lot of old unpublished Ditko stuff. And yeah, it's really interesting. So... And it's getting bigger and better, and you know, we wish those guys well, and they're a perfect you know, cross promotional machine.
Yeah.
So we're kind of working together with them to bring the whole thing together. And you know, Mort had the good idea to put one of our interviews in the newest issue of Arrow, and I think he's going to kind of try to make that a regular feature going forward.
That's interesting fandom synergy.
It is.
It's got to be interesting as you come across a lot of these creators who are like, I didn't know anybody even remembered that I did this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that they've got to see. I mean, every artist I know has some pride in their work, no matter how commercial it is.
Yeah.
And, or every writer for that matter. And even if they're just cranking it out, you know, to know that it made an impact, it's got to be interesting for somebody. What kind of responses have you gotten from guys like Denny O'Neill or Kupperberg or any of the folks that
they're all excited to do this. Mm-hmm. And I think the ones that stick out in my mind most, Neil Adams comes to mind.
Yeah.
We asked Neil if he would talk to us, and he said, well, I was at Charlton for a cup of coffee, but okay, I'll give you, you know, I'll say what I can. It'll probably take 5 minutes. We were a good half hour into it. We had to stop because we interviewed him in the main lobby of the con before it opened, and we didn't expect to go that long, and they wanted to open the show, and we were right in the way, so we had to pack up, and he wanted to keep going. once he started reminiscing and realizing that he actually did play a bigger role than he thought, because he was in charge of continuity for a couple titles. So him, or even like Jose Garcia Lopez, who's beyond terrified of a camera. you know, he's warming up more and more, and we're going to probably interview him again because we just ambushed him. But you know, he did a bunch of romance comics. He didn't know he was drawing for Charlton. His agent would just say, "Here, draw these," and he'd draw them. He didn't know who he was drawing.
And he just sent in the pages and didn't know when they'd show up or where, huh?
But even Joe Sinnott, you know, it got him thinking, and him and his son went and pulled all the titles he did, and it was over 2,000?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And, you know, they're all proud of that time. There was something, there's a little glimmer in the, you know, a gleam in their eye, and they get excited about it. Maybe it's because they had the creative freedom, or it's, you know, fond memories of where they got their start. You know, they all say the same thing. I wish I made more money and I didn't make any money there. But
they really loved what they did.
They did. Guys like Frank McLaughlin. I mean, he's so passionate about his time there. Just nobody seems to want to turn us down.
No.
We've got some camera shy people who are afraid. Mike Zeck is camera shy, but he's slowly warming up.
It was nice, though, when we saw Mike Zeck right after we interviewed George Wildman, and George actually kept a letter that Mike Zeck sent to him and said, "Hey, I heard Charlton's shutting down. Is it possible that I can get any of my old artwork back?"
Right.
And George was, he was able to follow through and get Mike Zeck some of his original pages back. So when Carl showed me this letter, I took a picture of it, and then I saw Mike Zeck at the con, and I told him I had this letter, and I showed him a picture of it, and it was on my phone. He took my phone and he stood there for like a solid 2 minutes and he reread that letter that he wrote to George 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And then I said, "I took some pictures of George. Do you want to see them?" And he goes, "Sure." And he looked at them, and just the way he was looking at them, it's like you could see, I keep saying, the love in his eyes. Like, these people really did love working for this company. There's something special about it.
And, you know, and we're still trying to show people that we're not fanboys with the camcorder.
Yeah.
You know, and what helped was dropping the trailer at the con at the Mohican Sun a year ago. Like, that, even the guys we were working with, like Paul Kupperberg, and when they saw it, they were like, "Oh, wow.
You guys are serious."
Roy Thomas, and they all went, "Wow, okay, this is not..."
Okay, this is legit. This is like, hey, remember
Bob?
Remember, you know, Peacemaker? That was awesome.
Yeah, and Bob Layton, too. I mean, he, you know, he asked me to call him. I called him up, and I said, "Hey, Bob, it's Keith from the Troll." And he goes, "I know who you are. I'm a big fan." And, like, it's kind of weird.
He's
showing the trailer all over L.A. and blah, 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 now that he's moved to Florida. But, yeah, that was big. So we're going to be cutting another one to launch again, you know, calendar year later, a new one. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
It's going to have a different tone. It's going to be fun.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Tell me about the change in tone.
We're just going to kind of make it even goofier.
You've seen movie trailers, the traditional movie trailer over and over, the same algorithm.
Right.
With the bass drop and the echoey voices and the sad look. So we're going to emulate your stereotypical movie trailer.
We're going to make it look like a real drama.
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
With the Charlton spin on it.
Yeah, with the Charlton spin on it. So, yeah, it's going to be kind of hilarious. Just cool. To kind of, you know, throw the people in a different direction. Like, what the hell are they doing?
And we can look for that toward the beginning of the year, huh?
No, we're going to drop it at the Mohegan Sun show again. So,
oh, great.
Yeah,
Mitch Halleck, the guy who runs that show, is a friend of ours, and he's been a huge supporter of this. So
Since day one.
And he did a spectacular interview for the thing. And so we kind of, you know, we're loyal, and Mitch is our guy. So every major piece of media will always drop at his shows, or, you know, so he gets first dibs on anything new that we do.
That's very fair. Are you coming to any of the West Coast conventions this season?
We'd like to. Budget, you know, it's a budgeting thing. We were asked to go to Emerald City Con to do a 15-minute panel or something. And I was like, we can't justify going all the way out. That's a lot of money that we could spend on a movie, you know. So we'll probably end up going that way afterwards, okay, when it's released. You know, we're hoping to get this done by late summer next year. And, you know, it depends on a couple of variables, but if that happens, then, you know, there'll be obviously a press tour, if you will.
A road show.
Yeah.
There you go. That'd be great. Well, you never know who's listening to Deep Dish Radio, and you've dropped a lot of names that have either been on the show or are in contact with the show. Are there interviews you want to get that you haven't been able to reach?
Oh, to reach?
Yeah.
I think we've talked to everybody. Yeah. It's just a matter of getting to them. And Keith and I both work freelance jobs. So
right,
our jobs, like, we can get a phone call tonight and we got to be in a different state tomorrow morning. So trying to coordinate our plans, and then on top of coordinating with another creative person saying, okay, we have next week free. Are you home?
You know, we're working out some things that might help alleviate that process and expedite things, if you will. So
sure.
I don't really want to go into that right now, but
okay,
it's for a future episode.
Yeah.
No, it's just, it's, you know, like you said, the names, that was kind of the idea behind the trailer too. The first trailer, Jackie and I put all our own resources into shooting that trailer and getting the heroes on there. We knew that if people saw Denny O'Neill, Bob Layton, Paul Kupperberg, Frank McLaughlin, Neil Adams, those kind of faces on there, it'd be like, holy shit.
Yeah. This is the real deal.
Right. Versus, you know, a couple of the guys that are local and not so well known. So I think that worked right away.
Yeah.
So I think that was definitely worth running around last summer to get that done.
And the other side of that is, once we interview these guys, like, we finish interviewing Denny and he goes, you talk to Steve Skates? Yeah, we're Facebook friends. Oh, how's he doing? And it's like, really? You haven't talked to your friend, but I'm his friend now. And they've been reaching out to each other and saying, hey, have you talked to the Trout guys yet?
Yeah, it's kind of cool. And what we want to do ultimately is, when it's finished, we want to have a big screening in the Manhattan area and put them all in the same room together.
Yeah.
Like, big old possibly for the last time, and allow, you know, maybe a certain number of fans or backers to come and be part of that. So that's kind of a pipe dream we have.
Definitely.
How far away from having a finished print are you?
Like I said, our goal right now, our target date is end of August next year. So right, you know, Labor Day-ish. And that's based on what we think could happen.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, if what we think happens doesn't happen and we have to keep cruising the way we're cruising, you might have to tack another year onto that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a work in progress. We just keep motoring along and doing what we can when we can.
But here's the other thing. Since we've started this project, it's almost as if it's been lying in wait. And it was just waiting. And I'm not going to say for the right people to come along, but this project has a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And Keith and I are just lucky to be the vehicles and the mouthpieces. Everything seems to fall into place when it needs to.
When it needs to. It's a good point.
So we're not worried about this project. There's a greater film god out there that's keeping watch over this and saying, it's going to happen when it needs to happen. So just do as you need to do.
Yeah.
And don't worry about it.
We originally were thinking very small with this project to sell it to the local PBS affiliate because it's a Connecticut story. And a friend of mine in LA, a producer, looked at my treatment and called me up and said, you're crazy. This has far more legs than that. This is a big project. So, and he was working with us until he passed away in February from ALS. I'm still not right with that. But a lot of the stuff he told us and how to be patient and this will take time and, you know, don't be surprised if this happens after this amount of time. He's kind of been right on target. He really has. So, you know, not that Dennis is watching down on us, but it's almost like he's been our little, just guiding us the whole way. He wasn't super active as a producer. His job was to get us distribution at the end, 'cause he had that all figured out. But, his timelines, and just be patient, and it's ebbs and flows, and it's been ebbs and flows. It's, you know, all of a sudden we'll just knock out a whole bunch of stuff, and then 3 or 4 weeks will go by and we don't lift a finger, you know?
Yeah.
But it all gets done. It's all right on schedule for the most part, as we originally mapped out. I look back, it was this time last year, we actually just got started shooting stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Has it really been a year already? That's amazing.
Yeah. We hatched the idea 2 years ago in August. It'll be 2 years in August.
Okay.
We did our first full-length interview in May of last year.
Right.
That was Joe Staten. We had done previous interviews with like Bob Layton and Paul Kupferberg, but they were just more soundbite interviews.
They were for the trailer. Yeah. Right. It was like we set up for 10 minutes and said, just give us trailer soundbites.
Yeah.
So we'll be doing Bob and Paul formally again.
Soon.
Yeah. But yeah, up to that point, it was pre-production. We were taking Kupferberg out to dinner and kind of figuring out whose role was what, and you know, how much they would be expecting on the back end, and you know, getting all those stupid things out of the way.
Right.
We've really taken our time and made sure that we're doing this right the first time. We owe it to the comic book legends that worked at this company. This movie's for them.
Yeah. In fact, we have a goal to donate a percentage of whatever we can get back to the Hero Initiative.
Excellent.
Which is another thing that spurned the whole idea. You know, I was looking at the flyer I got from Denny and at the con, and I was like, geez, I wish I could contribute more than like $50. You know, do something substantial. And then I was thinking about the panel. I went, oh my God, that's it. We make a movie and we sell the freaking movie, you know, and then I give some money to them. So, that's kind of the genesis of it.
Well, it is, it's clearly a labor of love, but it's also a business. So Deep Dishers, yeah. If you want to get behind this, the website is charltonmovie.com. And not only can you see pictures of Keith and Jackie, which are invaluable at any price, but you can also get behind this. There are opportunities for, to back this movie and get behind it. So if you're a Charlton fan, if you're a Charlton creator who hasn't yet been part of this yet, if you are just a comic book fan who, like our young friend, has burned out on all the, if you'll pardon the pun, burned out on all the Marvels and DCs, and you want to read something new by Jim Aparo or John Byrne or whatever, this is really something to get behind. It's charltonthemovie.com. Guys, why don't you tell us about the other social media where folks can connect with you?
We are on Facebook at Charlton Movie, same name on Twitter at Charlton Movie, and Instagram. Keith is over on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. We try to stay as active as possible.
Yeah. We do periscoping once in a while. In fact, all our panels will probably be periscoped going forward. Yeah. I mean, we can't do all the social media things. We've tried.
We're just a team of two. So we're doing the best we can to get out there to everybody out in
team
the world.
Team of two and a couple of buddies who volunteer to come crew with us on these shoots. That's invaluable. Can't thank them enough.
Yeah.
You know, hope to someday be able to repay them. Yeah, give them some cash for what they did.
Right, so now they're paid in coffee and donuts.
Hey, don't not coffee and donuts. I was in radio for 4 years and all I got was coffee and donuts.
There's nothing wrong with
that. And besides that, ironically, you pay better than Charlton.
And on that note, the Charlton Neo stuff, like we said before, if you go to moretod.com or it's charltonneo.blogspot.com, you can actually, if you're a creator, submit story or art, and there's a good chance that you might actually get picked up and printed. Mm. They aren't paying right now because they're self-publishing, but it's a chance to get some exposure.
Be part of history.
Yeah, so they're taking submissions, and you can become part of Charlton 2.0.
Gotta love it, guys. All right. Well, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Tim.
My pleasure. The website again, charltonthemovie.com. Check it out right now. Watch the trailers and then send these guys a check, will you? Because what they're doing is God's work.